It is week 29 of the year 2021, and this is Father Roderick to the Max. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Father Roderick to the Max. And I've got a lot of things to talk about, lots of stuff going on. First of all, in my personal life, of course, still working on the renovation of the rectory in Bennekom. I'm still staying in the loft at Father Henry's rectory, and well, let's put it this way. Father Henry is great company, but I am getting a little tired of living in this tiny space and not having my own kitchen, my own fridge, the wonky internet here in the house. There are days that it's really hard to wait. I guess it's all about patience. And the house, fortunately, is making progress every day. Barely a day goes by that I don't take my bike and ride it to Bennekom and look at the progress that it's been made. So the kitchen is now almost installed. That was quite an ordeal. So as you know, I bought the kitchen for the rectory in Hooglanderveen where I lived, but we never got around installing it because before I could start working on that, they started to try to get me out of the rectory. So I was stuck with that completely designed, ready to install kitchen. And the space that it was originally planned for was rectangular, whereas this kitchen is square. And so I spend quite a bit of time with IKEA on the phone and in their kitchen planner, redesigning the kitchen, try to make everything fit. And I think we came up with a really great compromise for the new kitchen that uses everything that we had bought, except for a few smaller details, not that important, not that expensive. But we got to use everything that we planned for the original kitchen. And I think the design is actually better. It creates a kitchen island. There is a lot of kitchen top space, which I always missed in my previous rectories. Always, I always need a lot of space to prepare, and I never had it. So this time, I made sure to have a lot of room for the preparation, especially if you do Chinese cooking and walking, etc. All that is 80% preparation, 20% cooking. So I'm happy with that. I'm really glad that we were able to maintain the kitchen island because I designed that originally to be able to also film in my kitchen and to share, you know, recipes and videos with my followers. And then, of course, you want to be able to position the camera in front of the person who is cooking. So I looked at a lot of kitchen and cooking videos, both amateur videos on YouTube as well as the ones made by the big companies, you know, and big television cooks. And I think that the design that we ended up with is really combines both the limitations of basically an IKEA kitchen and a limited budget with a design that I think with proper lighting can really result in some good videos that look attractive. Now, it is IKEA, so the only thing you get are boxes. And I knew that, you know, if it's just a simple desk or a cupboard, I can probably still do that myself. But a kitchen, there is the electricity, there's the water. The space in which we were installing the kitchen was completely empty. All the old electricity, as well as water and the drains, all had to be removed, and we had to re-drill holes and go to the basement and everything. So there was no way that I was going to install that myself. So I handed it over to the people that are helping me with the renovation. And they started building last week. Now, immediately, there were lots and lots of questions. So they called me all the time, like, so how do you want this? How do you want that? And then I had to come over and look at the situation and give some advice. Because the thing is with IKEA, you do get the boxes. You do get a manual per cupboard, but you don't get a manual on how to build the entire thing because it's custom. So they kind of think that you can figure that out for yourself. Well, that's not the case. It's a very specialized process. The hardest thing that I've ever seen with IKEA material, and actually, in hindsight, not something you should install yourself. They have an installation service. It's very expensive. It's easily a couple of thousand euros extra, which you have to add to the overall cost of the kitchen. Plus, they don't really warn you how difficult it is to install this kitchen and to install it well. Not to mention that, of course, this was a kind of patchwork kitchen. The tabletops, for instance, were designed for a totally different setup. And so we had to saw in half certain planks and glue them together. And there was a lot of these kitchen tops were custom made by IKEA. You actually pay extra for that. And so I didn't want to throw them away and buy new ones. So we tried to recycle as much as we could the original material. But that in itself was difficult. So at one point, I arrive in the evening. Usually the workmen are there early in the morning and they leave at around 3. So I was there at 5. And I look at the kitchen and I was like, wow, this looks great. I posted a picture on Instagram and Facebook. And then something struck me. There was a set of drawers on the right side, next to the oven and the cooking station. But the drawers, you couldn't open them because the side of the drawers hit the side of a door that was next to it. And so I was like, how is this possible? How can this be? Did we make a mistake in designing it? Did IKEA make a mistake? Basically, these drawers are unusable. You cannot have both the drawers and the door next to it. So the door was in a 90-degree angle because the entire kitchen is in a U shape. It's kind of difficult to explain it just using words. But the thing was, there was something wrong with the design. So I looked at the computer drawing, and then I looked back. It was kind of hard to see what was going on, and all of a sudden it struck me. I was like, there's got to be a separator between the drawers and that part of the kitchen, and then the part of the kitchen that is against the wall. And that it's literally like a 5-inch separator. That one had not been assembled. It was forgotten, was overlooked. And so what they did was to put all these cupboards against one another, but there is no room to open the drawers. There's no room for the doors to open. The thing was, they had already glued and installed everything on top of that. So the entire kitchen top was already fixed. The position of the the suction thing that is above the cooking station to get rid of the cooking smells and whatnot was positioned exactly above the cooking station. If you would move the thing, if you would disassemble the entire thing and move it to the right in order to recreate that space, then everything above it would also be misaligned. So I immediately thought, well, there's no way we can disassemble and start again. What you would normally do with IKEA, you always know if there are some leftover elements, then you probably forgot something. It's always your fault. It's never IKEA's fault. So you have to start again, which is super frustrating if you're doing something as simple as a cupboard or a desk. But this was an entire kitchen. And I was like, oh my gosh, no. What are we going to do? And I literally didn't sleep for an entire night. That's how distressed I was. It's like that. We ruined the kitchen. There's no way back. There's no way to fix this. And then The next day I went back, it was a Saturday, so there was no one at the rectory, and I just stood there in the kitchen for hours, and I was like, how can we fix this? How can we fix this? How can we fix this? And then I just went for a walk or a bike ride, and it came back. And then all of a sudden it clicked. It's like, I know how to fix this. I know what to do. Yeah, it's a hack. It's not ideal, but I can still save this kitchen. And it was basically, the trick was to take the drawers out and move them to the opposite side. The drawers themselves were not full length. They were 40 centimeters instead of 60. 60 is the total width of a cupboard. So there was already, if you move them to the opposite side, then it would create a space of around 5 inches on the side of the doors that normally couldn't open. But now if you move the drawers there, you have the space to open the drawers. And then, or to both open the drawers and to open the doors. And then in the place where the drawers would be, we could install a smaller door. There are 40 centimeter doors. And because they have just hinges, it's much easier to open them, even if you don't have much wiggle room there. It would work on that side. And so that's what I proposed on Monday, and man, I was so glad. And actually, it turned out it worked like that. So it's different from the design that we had. And then there were tons of other things. So they had installed a heating device, because there is no warm water in that kitchen, or in that part of the house. At least, no, there's no central connection to the hot water that we use, for instance, for the shower. That comes from the attic. And there was no way to connect it to the kitchen. So we had to install a separate device for that. They installed it in the wrong cupboard. They installed it right underneath the sink. But that, in the design, we deliberately did not put it there, because the part under the sink was supposed to have two drawers in it that you need to be able to close. But now the device was there, and so you couldn't put the drawers in there. I was like, shoot. Ah, now, what now? Oh, well, we'll have to give up on the drawers. But what are we going to put in place? And then I was like, well, wait a minute. I now have one door that is left over, because we moved the drawers to the left, and we have to make or buy a smaller door next to the oven. So I have this spare door. Well, okay, drawers would be nice, but we'll just put a door there. And ultimately, because I had moved the drawers, there was no other way to place the heating device other than right underneath the sink. So no matter what, if they had moved it in the cupboard where it was originally planned, we wouldn't have been able to move the drawers. So, yeah. Everything came together. But, man, this was migraine stuff. I was so happy that it all turned out well. But, man, it was just one of those moments that you just feel the ground under you disappear, and there's this abyss of distress. And there have been so many of these situations. Like, they are currently putting like fiberglass wallpaper on the walls, because the house itself is all concrete, and so you can do paper wallpaper. But that, of course, it's not ideal, because there are, you know, the walls are not perfect. And so the advice is usually just put on this kind of more flexible material. So even if there will be some cracks in the walls, you won't be able to see it. So they did that upstairs, and then we still have to paint that. So you got the questions of, okay, which colors? That's another thing. Like, colors, so many choices. What am I going to do? Am I going to do like the same beige-brown combination that I had in my previous rectory? I'm thinking, well, that worked fine there, but it somehow just didn't match the style of this rectory. And I felt maybe I should just go for something super light, very, very, very light gray, which is what we ultimately ended up putting in the hallways. And then I asked the painter for advice, and he said, well, I would just paint, use that color also in the smaller rooms upstairs, because it creates a bit of a contrast with the white woodwork of the doors and the cupboard. So, okay, we'll just go for super light gray. But then, and then that actually also works really well in the kitchen, because that's all white tiles and blue cupboards. So works really well. But for the living room, I'm just not sure. You kind of want the living room to feel a bit warmer. So I'm still on the fence about the colors there. But I can take my time choosing the colors, because it turns out that the entire ceiling, and this is now because we removed the big safe that was in there, the parish safe and the chimney next to it, we completely removed that big block of stone. It's now a huge room, and that's wonderful. The problem is it also has a huge ceiling, and it turns out that the ceiling is in terrible shape. What they did since the 50s when the house was built was just paint over the previous layers of paint. So the ceiling has about 3 or 4 layers of paint. However, they never really did that with expertise. They just took some white paint, anything, and just started painting over the previous layer of paint. The thing is, the under layer, the layer, the earliest paint layer, is a totally different type of paint. It's much more porous. It's more chalky. This is probably the kind of paint that they used a lot in the 50s. It's cheap. But it's not the kind of, you know, very super strong type of you know, quality paint that you can buy nowadays. But because the earliest layer was so chalky, so powdery, the other layers are starting to come off and fall off. And I was, again, it was this realization that, well, wait a minute, if we have to completely redo the ceiling, and you consider that if you hire someone to completely redo the walls and the ceiling, you're paying about $30 per square meter. We're talking about 30, 40 square meters. It's just a ton of a huge surface. It would cost me thousands of euros. Plus, these guys are in high demand right now, so it could also potentially postpone the renovations for maybe months. And I was like, oh no, don't tell me I'll still be here with Christmas. I so want to move. I miss having a home. So the painter who was helping me with the fiber wallpaper, I asked him, can you give me some advice? You must have seen this before. And then today I arrived there in the morning, and they were removing all these layers of paint from the ceiling. And he said, well, he explained to me why the ceiling was coming down. And he said, there's no choice. Either this falls off, either remove it now, or it will fall off in the next year. But then you will have all your furniture, and the floors will be redone, and then you'll still have to do the ceiling. So there is no choice. We have to remove these extra layers of paint. Then we have to fixate the earliest layer of paint, and then we can try to straighten it as much as possible and repaint it. He said, this is a ton of work, but I'm still going to do it. You know, we will take, it will take us a few weeks to remove, a few weeks, because these guys are professional painters. So they do this in between, that just to do me a favor. But oh my goodness, so much work. But thankfully, we could save it in a slightly simpler way. It's still a heck of a job, but at least it won't be the total, you know, basically redoing the entire ceiling and all the walls. So we're just going to use the same wallpaper downstairs, and then we can paint over it. So it's much more work than I would like, but it's still much less than it could have been. And this is kind of the mantra of the whole house. It's like, disaster, stress. I don't sleep anymore. And then the next day, okay, it's still a disaster, but it's not the kind of disaster that we expected it to be. And then the day after that is, okay, we think we've found a way. It's just going to take a few weeks more. And then, so that's why when I initially came here and we were kind of fixing up the things, I was genuinely convinced that it would only take a few weeks. It's going to take more than half a year in total. If I'd known, well, I still didn't have a choice. I couldn't stay in the old rectory. My bishop wanted me or ordered me to leave before, you know, in Holy Week of all weeks. And so I just had to take whatever was available. And it turns out it was this rectory that is really a nice place to live. Only, good Lord, a fixer-upper, as if I've never seen before. So, the patience. And most of the time, I just keep focusing on the positive. You know me. I just revel. I'm just excited to see the house come together, and I really value the quality of the work that has been done. I try not to think about the incredible amount of money that it's using up so much of my savings. But then again, I tell myself, this is why you have savings. It's for these unexpected things in life. It's the same thing when my car breaks down. It's not a problem because I've saved for so many years. I try to live a very, very modest life so that I have this margin for situations in which I have to spend a lot of money on necessities. This is not luxury. This is just we had no choice but to fix the house. And the same is true. If your washing machine breaks down, well, you can't walk around a year in dirty clothes. You need to have a replacement. So that's why I have these savings. And that's why I'm also really glad. You may remember this from maybe a year ago in one of these episodes. I talked about budgeting and how the budgeting system that I was using was telling me you give every dollar a name. So basically, well, in my case, every euro a name. You have to have a purpose for the money that you save. Otherwise, you might as well give it away. And that was the first time I've been brought up with this discipline of saving and setting aside. Even my allowance, I would save it up because I loved computer games, and for the computer that I had back then, the ZX81, these games were expensive. I'd have to save several months to buy one game, and then the game itself was like 8 kilobytes. Which I could still run on the regular computer. But then there were other games, especially the adventure games, that were a whopping 16 kilobytes. Oh my goodness, that is so much memory. So you had to buy, I had to save an entire year and combine it with the savings of my brother to get a 16 kilobyte module that you had to plug into the back. And then we could run these other programs. So, as a child, I've been always brought up with the idea that if you want something, you gotta save up for it. And I've continued to do this for my entire life. But it's also important, and that is something I've only recently learned, that you need to have a purpose. It's just, of course, you can save up money, but why? You could be dead tomorrow. But if your money has a purpose, then it makes sense to save because you know why you do it. And now I'm in a situation where I don't know what I would have done had I not saved up the money for a future house. I was actually saving it for a hobbit hole for when I retire. I still want to move to, I don't know, New Zealand and build myself a copy of the Shire. But, well, that will have to wait. I need a house right now. The hobbit hole is still for the future. But, oh well. So it's, I try to focus on the progress that we're making, and I know that once I move over, it's probably going to be October at the earliest, this time of waiting and the little frustrations of not really having my own home and being in a house where I can't really find the kind of peace that I need as an introvert. I'm living in a house with only extroverted people. All that will be hopefully soon forgotten. But in the meantime, I try just... some days it's really hard. Like this afternoon I was podcasting and I wanted to stream it. Maybe you were in the audience. And they have cable internet here and it's terrible. And everything here, when it comes to connections, whether it is water or electricity or internet, it is completely... it's a total mishmash. It's a mess. It's a total mess. So no wonder that it... and it's already a bad connection and then a cheap cable internet subscription that they have. I intervened to make sure that they didn't miss the boat on fiber. So we finally got notice that they will get a fiber connection next month. But then I'll almost be gone. My time here will be over. And then it's even then, I'm not sure that I won't get these same dropouts because the internet is going through so many different wires and it's been done in such an amateurish way. I have no confidence. I just don't believe that it's going to improve much. But when you're actually in a conversation with people that follow you, I'm in the middle of a podcast and then people start posting comments like, oh, where did the stream go? What was the movie that Father Roderick was talking about? Where did he go? And then I try to fire up the program and it doesn't want to because the program basically crashed because of the lack of connection. Then I force quit the program, start it again, launch a new stream, which also disconnects within a minute. And I'm doing that while I'm recording a podcast and I have to keep on talking. You know, those moments, I want to throw something. I'm just... oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, offer it up, some people would say. That's what I'll do. I'll just offer it up. I have no choice anyway, which is kind of the story of my life right now. Let's dive into the kitchen. In my regular show, I talked about the Pixar movie Luca and how in the movie they are cooking pasta. And the pasta that you see is actually based on real Italian recipes, which is so cool. And I spoke briefly about a video that was...
here at Simpletivity.
Hold on, what is this? This is the wrong video. They posted...
Ciao!
This.
I am Enrico Casarosa, and I'm the director of Disney and Pixar's Luca. I am here today to take you on an exciting pasta tour. The pasta from our film and the pasta from my childhood.
Come on, I'll show you some more stuff.
What's wonderful about trofia is that it's a short pasta and you can see how it's made. It's made with this beautiful gesture. Oh, look at that technique. It's amazing. We wanted to use them in the movie because actually they're even more typical than trenette, which we used. But it wasn't as interesting as a long pasta. That's why we went for trenette, because when Luca and Alberto are grabbing them with their hands, it just felt wonderfully messy.
Oh.
Okay. We definitely wanted to have these little details right? Like that it wouldn't just be pesto. It would be the one with the detail of string beans and potatoes.
And this continues. This is a wonderful video. I'll link to it. Actually, I've linked to it in the show notes of the other show. And it gives you a demonstration of all the local pasta dishes. These are not the ones that everybody knows. These are pretty, you know, niche pasta recipes. And you see the some ladies cook them, and then the director is commenting on them because he's Italian. And it just makes you want to cook pasta. And it really made me appreciate the movie so much more because of all the details they got right. This movie could only be made by an Italian. So the actual pasta that, so here they, he's commenting on the this type of pasta, which is like these tiny little bits. He said, you know, it visually it's not good enough. We need a long pasta. So they made a pasta called trenette al pesto. Pesto is the sauce, and trenette is the type of pasta. And I found the original recipe. BuzzFeed has a great article, and they even show you some of the artwork from Pixar that they use to prepare for the scenes where the pasta is made and where the pasta is cooked. And it has the entire recipe, and it's actually not that hard. So I'll just give you the ingredients here. You need 500 grams of trenette. Now, that is hard to get. I Googled it here in the Netherlands. I can't find it, at least not in the big stores here. So it's you have to order it online, and it's pretty expensive. But you can also use linguine, for instance. Those are much easier to find. And, of course, worst case, just use spaghetti. It's the same idea. You just need these long pasta tubes, basically. Then you need 100 grams of green beans, which is very cool because you hardly ever see green beans in pasta. This is a vegetarian recipe, by the way. You have to cut them into 1-inch pieces. So don't use the long green beans, but make them slightly smaller. Then you need one large yellow potato, and you have to cut them into 1-inch cubes. Now, then the pesto is, of course, the most important ingredient for the overall taste. The potato and the beans are just there to add some legumes and also to give it a different bite than just pasta. But the sauce, the pesto, that's where the magic happens. Now, of course, you want to make this yourself because it's a totally different taste from the prefab pesto that you would buy at the stores. Usually there's loads of salt in those, and it's just, it doesn't compare. What you need is 45 leaves of basil. You want to have the round leaves, the big round leaves. You can grow the basil yourself. I just usually buy a few of those plants and make sure you water them at the base. Never pour water over your herbs. It will kill them. Instead, you put them in a little container and then you pour some water every second day on the bottom, and then it will suck up the water. Otherwise, if you add, and this is true also for flowers and plants, if you just pour water on top of the, you know, the stems of the plants, most of the water will go to the bottom via the sides, and the middle can still stay dry. So that is why sometimes your plants and flowers will die. The best thing is to let the plant itself suck it from the bottom. Of course, it requires you to have a pot that is open on the bottom. And then you just cut off the leaves yourself, and with a bit of luck, it will grow back. So 45 leaves, 50 grams, more or less. Then you need 2 cloves of garlic, a pinch of coarse salt. Now, with salt, I'm always like, just taste it. Taste if it's not salty enough, just add a little bit. It's easier to add than to subtract, of course. Then you need 2 tablespoons of grated Parmigiano and 2 tablespoons of grated Pecorino. Pecorino is, of course, the sheep's cheese. Both Parmigiano and Pecorino, you can just buy them at a cheese store or maybe at your local supermarket. It is worth it. It's much cheaper to just buy a whole chunk and then grate it yourself than to buy it pre-grated. And then, of course, since you will have you know, these bigger chunks of Pecorino and Parmigiano, you'll also be tempted to use it more, which is always a good thing, right? So 2 tablespoons of grated Parmigiano, 2 tablespoons of grated Pecorino. The Pecorino is a little bit more sharp. The taste is sharper than Parmigiano, so I actually like it. But it's, you know, the Parmigiano is there to kind of take the edge of the Pecorino. Then you take a handful of pine nuts. That is also very important, about 30 grams. And then about 100 milliliter of extra virgin olive oil, the green one. And then, of course, the better quality, the better. But it can also be very expensive. Then you put the leaves first and the cloves of garlic. And then you start, you use I don't know what the term is in English, but this stone it's not a hammer, but anyway, you crush it. And then you add a little bit of oil, and then you crush it even more. You add a little bit of oil until it becomes this paste. You add the parmigiano, the pecorino. The pine nuts should be in there from the get-go as well. And then you just keep adding olive oil. It, you know, you can let it rest for a while. It will stay good for several weeks. Just put it in a bottle, or in a, not in a bottle, in a small container, put it in the fridge. But that is the main ingredient for this dish. Then what you then do, if the manual stuff with, oh, the mortar and the pestle, that's how it's called. If that's too much work or you don't have a mortar and pestle, you can also put it in a food processor. The thing is, my experience with food processors is that doesn't really work for small amounts. It works if you want to do a whole bunch of pesto. Otherwise, it will just be all over the place. It will be sticking to all the sides of your food processor, and it's very hard to actually turn it into a good paste. So I like the manual process. It's more fun as well, but it is much easier for smaller quantities. So that's on my list as well for my new kitchen. I got to get myself a mortar and pestle. Then you boil water, add some salt. You always have to put a good amount of salt in when you cook pasta. Otherwise, it is tasteless. Then you throw in the pasta and immediately also the green beans and the potato. Now, that's why it's important to cut these beans and potatoes into small pieces. Otherwise, they won't be ready. They need to cook around the same time as the pasta itself. Now, of course, you know how to make pasta al dente, not too soft. Once the pasta is ready, then the beans and the potato will be probably fine as well. You can use about 500 grams of pasta for this, so you can feed several people, depending on their hunger. Always keep a bit of the pasta water, of course, for the sauce, so you can make it a little bit more liquid. And then the trick is to mix it all together. You'd think put the pasta first and then the sauce on top. It's actually the opposite. Put the pesto on the bottom of the bowl, then add a bit of pasta water, few spoonfuls, and then add the pasta and mix it up. It will make it much, much easier to get a good consistent mixture of the sauce and the pasta itself. Make sure also to use a big pan for that. If you have 500 grams of pasta, of course, that will swell up with the water. If the pan is too small, you're going to have a hard time mixing it all together without having it spill over all your the surroundings. An alternative, of course, is to just put it in a pan. But with the pesto, you don't want to heat that up. The pesto has to be cold. You mix it in cold. And then you add a few leaves of basil on top. And you don't, this is very important, you don't add extra cheese. So no pecorino, no other cheese, because the cheese is already in the sauce. So real the etiquette of the Italian kitchen is never waste ingredients. If there's already cheese, parmigiano, pecorino in the dish itself, you don't add it afterwards. This is also something with certain types of pasta. I think that pasta with seafood also does not require cheese, because the seafood has a very delicate taste. If you add pecorino, for instance, it will overpower the taste of the seafood and you won't taste it anymore. So it makes sense. This is not just, you know, Italian unwritten rules. They're handed over for no reason whatsoever. No, there's a reason to the rhyme. So that would be the recipe for trenetta al pesto. I'm definitely going to try it out one of these days, and I'm looking forward to sharing at least a photo of it online.
Just look at the x-rays. You see that dark spot there? Whiplash.
Whiplash? Oh no.
And this smudge here, that looks like my fingerprint? No, that's trauma.
One thing I always have to do when I eat and when I prepare food is to make sure I don't overeat, which is hard when it's so good. But I am actually on a very important quest to get healthy again, to get fit. I've started to implement a number of routines in my days and in my weeks, and it's working out really well. The hardest one to do, strangely enough, is the push-ups. So I made this tiny habit that every time I enter my room, I do push-ups. I started with 2. The next week, I did 4. This week, I'm doing 8. And I try to do it with proper form, which means you lower yourself to the ground until your nose hits the floor, but you don't rest, and then you stretch all the way up until your arms are straight. There's no cheating. It's not useful to cheat. It's all about the form, and that will then hopefully strengthen my arms a bit. Now, the idea that I had was to then switch from 8 to 16 next week, because by doing this a lot, you will get stronger. I don't know if that's the best way to to increase the amount of push-ups, because from 4 to 8, that's still feasible, but 8 to 16, that's a big leap, not to mention 16 to 32. I don't know if I can do it, but at least I'm gonna do as much as I can, and if I can't make it, then I'll just lower the amount a little bit. That's the whole principle of tiny habits. Make it super easy first, preserve the habit, do it. Even if you can't do 8 push-ups, do 2 or 4. Doesn't matter, as long as you keep doing the routine. And so that's one. The second thing is I've been training for the marathon with the Hal Higdon schedule. I'm using the app for the first time, which I really like. I thought it would just give me like a digital version of the schedules that he has online that I normally just printed out and followed it. But this is much better. It gives you like a personalized, calculated overview of the distances that you have to do, the speed at which you have to run it. So it's much finer tuned to my current form and, the stuff that I've done before. And it gives you every day not just what you should do, but it also gives you advice. And so, for instance, it's more important to watch your heart rate than to watch your overall speed. For some reason, the app thinks that my kind of relaxed speed is 6.3 minutes per kilometer. That's actually quite strenuous for me. So maybe I made a mistake. But the thing is, he also says in the comments, just make sure you run at about 70% of your maximum heart rate. So I know that for me at my age, that's around 125. So I just watch the heart rate instead of the speed or the distance is important, but the heart rate is the most important. That's how you actually build endurance. So if you overtrain, that can cause all sorts of problems. And at first, of course, since I haven't run a marathon in 2 years now, I really wanted to make sure I would equal my really good time during the Amsterdam marathon, and so I'm training for that time. But I kind of ignored the warnings that you shouldn't overtrain. Well, the mistake that I made was some days I have to just do these small distances, like 5 kilometers, 6 kilometers. That's half an hour. That is about the distance between here and Bennekom. So I would combine that in the morning. I would just get dressed and put on my running shoes and run to my home and just have a talk with the people working there so I can keep an eye on the proceedings. And if there are any questions or problems, I can chime in. But the road from this town to my new town, even though it's 5 kilometers, it's a pretty boring road, especially the first part that is that you have to run here in the city. And so I discovered a detour, which is much longer. It's about 2-3 kilometers more, but it goes through the woods and you're in nature and it's on the countryside. And it's a really, really, really beautiful run. The only thing that I did not take into account is that it goes up and down. There's a lot of hills there. And so last week, I had only run for about 2.5 kilometers, and I suddenly have to stop because I feel this knife stuck in my thigh. And I was like, oh, what is that? An injury. And it turns out I've probably overstretched my legs because I'm not used to running on hills. I've always trained on flat surfaces, and all my runs were also on flat. The Netherlands is flat. This is the where I live right now is an exception. You've got some hills because of, you know, the ice times or the ice ages here. But my legs have never trained on hills, and that is probably why I overtrained. And then the hard thing is, you got to stop training. And that is so difficult because you feel like, oh, but if I stop training, I'll fall off the bandwagon. I won't be able to do the distance. And, another disaster. The thing is, it's all about patience. It's better to first heal and wait and run a little less. Just trust the process. You'll be fine. There's still so many weeks left before I have to run the race. But it's better to heal first and prevent injuries than to continue with an injury, which will ultimately lead to an injury that can basically knock you out of the race. And I've had, at one point, also by overtraining, an injury that lasted more than half a year. I don't want to repeat that. So, this past weekend, I've been running these longer distances. I took like 3 days off to heal. And then I ran about 11 kilometers on a very flat itinerary. Then the next day I did a half marathon, I think, on Sunday. It was a hot day, but it was also, I was fine. So I'm thinking, okay, I think I'm over this. I think I just escaped a disaster. And then I made the same mistake. I went back and took the detour and I went up the hill. And then this time I arrived at the rectory without a problem. And then on the way back, I feel that same pain. I was like, oh gosh, I overtrained again. I overstretched. I should not have done this. Well, it's better to take a more boring itinerary and make sure you don't get injured than to enjoy the environment and, you know, get injured. So today is supposed to be training day because tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday, I've got to do these long distances, but I cannot run. Which means also if I can't run, I have to be even more careful with the amount of food that I eat because I don't want to go over budget. Right now, I came from a few weeks ago. I weighed 83 kilograms, which for my size, my height, is too much. I'm overweight. My ideal weight is 66 kilograms. That is super tiny. That is very, very slim. I don't recall the last time that I weighed that little. But I want to give it a try. I want to see if I can really get to, you know, the right weight for my height. And it's also an opportunity for me to focus on the healthy stuff. So if you can't eat much, you want to make sure that what you eat is as healthy as possible and as filling as possible. So with all that combined, I've been able to lose 8 pounds already in just a few weeks. So that is looking good. I'm now at 79. So coming from 83, that's not too bad. So I'm pretty confident that I can lose weight quickly, provided, of course, that I keep counting my calories, that I keep sleeping a lot, because sleep is also super important, which, you know, it's not always easy, because sometimes I can't sleep because I'm just worried and I don't know, frustrated or nervous because of the situation or because of the IKEA kitchen problems. But I try to sleep as much as I can. Tonight is going to be another test of my patience, because you can't hear it, but I hear it all the time. I try to talk over it. The bloody students, the neighbors are out there on their stupid balcony just yelling and making noise. Oh, I so hate that kind of noise. And they continue, they're students, so they usually continue until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And It's not like just like I would prefer like a highway next to my window instead of students, because it's just yelling and it's just stupidity. And I hated it when I was young, hated it when I was a student, and I hate it now. and I have no choice. Again, I have no alternative. I have to just wait for them to pass out because they've been drinking too much, which is what they usually do during the weekends. And this is Friday evening, Saturday evening, and Sunday, thankfully, because they have to go to college the next day. They usually wrap up earlier, but it's so... I try to focus on the positive. I try to focus on the positive, but there are days that I'm literally, I've got my, you know, my teeth clenched of frustration that I'm still in this room, and it's... Sometimes I just want to go to France and live like a hermit and be done with all this noise around me. Pray for me. I need it. I really need it. So, as you've noticed, I've moved the discussion of Traditiones Custodes, which was the motu proprio of Pope Francis about the extraordinary rite, so the old Latin Mass. I moved that to the main show because I got a few questions of people that really wanted to hear my opinion on the whole situation, so that's what I did. Here in the liturgy segment, it would be more kind of more appropriate because this is dedicated to liturgy. But it's kind of a technical discussion, so I was afraid that the kind of more general listeners, not everyone is Catholic who's listening to this show, and nor should they be, or I'm not, it's not a requirement at all. So I didn't want to overburden them, but ultimately I ended up kind of trying to explain it with all the nuances that are important, I think, in this whole discussion. But it really has had the effect of making me think about the masses that I celebrate. And one of the reasons that I keep missing the masses that I had, the online ones, was that for me was an opportunity to also try to, and I didn't do that by myself. I also had Hank and Inge to help me out and some other people to try to make that a really simple yet beautiful, reverent liturgy. And I think with all the limitations of the situation, and even though we couldn't really have a big choir or anything, I still think that those masses, I miss them because of they were just really nice. And also for me, it was such a pleasure to celebrate those masses because you knew that with Hank, everything is in good hands. It's just, you know, no surprises, sometimes a little bit of stress because of technical reasons or... You know, a few times we tried to celebrate Ad Orientem, and that turned out to be almost impossible because you just the microphone and the church itself was not really appropriate for that. So there have been moments where we tried out stuff and it didn't work, but I have some fond memories of many of those masses, and so have some of you. You've let me know. So the now I often can celebrate. Sometimes I fill in for Father Henry if he's unable to go to a parish. But then you're back. I'm back where I started. I'm back in the parish. And in a lot of these parishes in the Netherlands, the liturgy is so-so. It's not really good. I mean, it's okay. And with Father Henry, of course, there's nothing outrageous there. But it's not very beautiful. You know, there are many churches where they don't even have altar boys or girls, and the choirs, most of the choirs here are very mediocre. I hate to say it because I know that everybody loves to sing and it's much more than just the quality of the songs, but when for an entire mass you have to listen to a choir, and this is across the board, whether it's young people or students or older people singing Gregorian chant or even, you know, polyphony, a lot of these choirs are so bad. And it's also the kind of music that is, I feel like we should be done with that. I honestly prefer just simple Gregorian chant over these more fancy masses that are maybe one time when the choir was still filled with young people and no one had hearing aids, maybe the masses would still be okay. Although I don't like the concert performative type of masses. I like stuff that you can sing along with. That's why I like Gregorian chants. You can sing along and everybody knows these melodies. But when the choir is older and they're forcing themselves to perform masses that they actually can't do anymore, it becomes so painful. And I'm thinking, well, I have to be here. But if it were up to me, I wouldn't be here, at least not for the music. And also, there is something about the liturgy. I feel like you need movement. Why is nowadays, and I know that is part of the newer liturgical rules, that everybody who has a function on the altar, around the altar, should wear white robes. An alb, which is albus, is white for, is a Latin for white. But I grew up as a child with a black and white, or red and white, a red cassock and a white thing you wear on top of it. I don't have the English words for that. And I think it looks so much prettier than just the white stuff that is often just homemade by, you know, some volunteers. And it has no class. It just visually, it doesn't look like anything. And then if you have these masses where there is nothing happening around the altar, it's all verbal, it's all readings, homily, prayers, then you move to the altar, and there is no frankincense, there are no bells. There is just this one lady who does everything, so there are not multiple functions. The liturgy becomes so impoverished and so poor and so hard to get into for me as a priest, and also I think for the people in church. And so I keep thinking, you know, maybe I should really try to find my own little space. I need to carve out my own space for these online masses, because not only was it serving a purpose for those of you that can't go to mass, and, you know, you got to keep in mind that some of my listeners live in Australia and New Zealand. Australia is currently, you know, 80% in lockdown. So the situation is not... You hear this? This is what I have to put up with. Like, and it continues until 2 o'clock in the morning. They've been at this since 5 o'clock. It's now 9:30. Oh, yeah. It's all the booze, of course, that... some people will tell me, but haven't you been young? Well, not like that. Sorry. I was a quiet kid. So, I really think I should continue these online masses, because it's also, I think, a place where we can do liturgy well and also show the participants, this is how you can celebrate the new liturgy or the post-Vatican II liturgy in a reverent way. And I think that is the biggest reason of all the uproar about the motu proprio of Pope Francis, because people think that you need that old liturgy for to have a good religious experience during Mass. And unfortunately, in many parishes, that is true. In the sense that the current liturgy is so subpar that they long for something that is more reverent. But I truly believe that you can totally do that with the regular liturgy. But you need to focus on quality, and you need to dare to make some changes and stop making the liturgy just an exercise in self-expression. And, you know, choirs that can't sing anymore, the argument that is often used is, but these are volunteers. They like singing. They love singing. And then I'm like, but then you're back in this idea of liturgy as self-expression. If these people want to sing and they can't sing, well, it's all about, you know, them wanting to sing. And it's like, no, this is about a certain quality of liturgy that is conducive to prayer. And if you constantly have to listen to awful music, it takes you away from God. It hurts your relationship with God at that moment. It takes you out of the experience. And it's the same thing with my work, my daily work. When I'm editing, I go for quality. I can't just deliver a half-baked product thinking, well, people just have to see the effort that I put in it. And, well, too bad if the editing is not good. No. If the sound is bad, if the editing is choppy, if the music is horrible, then nobody will watch the TV show, and I will get into big problems. I have to deliver quality. There is a certain standard, and the thing is with parishes and parish liturgy, there's no one to protect that standard or to hold to set a certain quality level that we need to attain. And if it's all about, you know, just being together and having a good time, I don't think we'll get out of this rut that we're currently in liturgically. That's my two cents, and I'm sticking with it. Switching gears here and wrapping up with some comments on a type of game that I found in my Steam library, and I hadn't played these games since my youth. I'm from the generation that still played in arcades. Some of you are also of that generation or even older than I am, but also lots of you are much younger. You've never really known that era. You may be from the Nintendo generation or the Sega generation, which is something I completely skipped because I was in seminary at the time. We didn't even have a TV. So, but those classic Atari games hold a very special place in my memories. When I was still in high school, I would go to the local toy store, and they would have these Atari consoles, the early ones, the 2600s, and I would play Pac-Man until they kicked me out of the store, and I just loved those classic games. And so I found this vault of classic Atari games that I bought probably during a sale years ago. Never really launched it. And it was so fun to play some of these games. So we've got Red Baron and Centipede, Lunar Lander. I remember that one. It's super frustrating. Asteroids. Oh my goodness. I remember that in a bar where sometimes during the weekend we would go to get fries. We weren't able to make fries ourselves, so every once in a while my dad would fancy some French fries. And we would go to the village, and there would be this bar/restaurant, and you could order your fast food there. And then they had an Atari console, like this big, you know, old-fashioned box, basically, or cabinet, with a TV, a black and white TV in it, and then a joystick. And there was this one guy who was so good at Asteroids that he could play for an hour without having to pay for it. And I would watch that guy with amazement because these levels get super hard after a while. I was like, oh my goodness, I wish I could play that myself. And because, of course, I did not have the allowance to play these games there, nor did we have an arcade in the village where I lived. So I so wanted to have an Atari. I never got one, by the way. My mom thought it was a waste of money. Video games are not good for you. That's probably why I'm overcompensating so much. Now that I'm old and I have the money and I have the time. But I remember those games, and there's still this nostalgia of this like, I so dreamt of having being able to play these games instead of just watching someone else play them. Breakout, that game much later than Lunar Lander and Asteroids, and Breakout was so cool, and again, so hard to play. Pong, that was the first one. Sometimes you would still see those in my youth. I remember a hotel where I was, and in the lobby they had like this old-fashioned Pong. So basically a TV inside a table. Fascinating stuff. And then there was this racing game, which I also thought was amazing because it had these racing sounds. The cars would do like, And that was the only game that I remember that had sound. Pong, I think it just had to like boop, 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 boop. And then Lunar Lander, if you crashed your Lunar Lander, which you ultimately always did, it was just like, that was the only sound effect. Whereas the cars, they kind of like sounded like cars. It was cool. So I was playing these games with my, you know, Xbox controller on my big monitor. And wow, sometimes my memory definitely outclasses the reality, because these games are unplayable, seriously. And it's also because we used to play these games with joysticks, with micro switches. So that if you moved the joystick to the left, you would literally hear it click. It would do click, 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 click. And you could do very precise navigation. You can't do that with modern controllers, because it's all about smooth movements, you know, tiny little movements of your thumbs. It's great if you play modern games. It's a disaster for these classic games. So anyway, it was fun seeing these games, but I don't think I'll play them a lot. And these were the kind of the wireframe graphics. This is not an emulation of the Atari 2600 or 2400. I think it's 2600. Anyway, those actually were a bit more chunky with graphics. I think they used sprites instead of, but it was still cool to still be able to play these prehistoric precursors of modern day gaming. And it's unbelievable to see how far we've come in just my lifetime. And well, I'm old, but I'm not that old. So I'm so looking forward to what the future has in store. I think if you would have told me as a child that the kind of games that I'm playing now, including VR, I would have thought that you were, Dark Vader from the planet Vulcan. All right, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for being a patron, and talk to you soon.